From Academy Award-winning writer-director Jordan Peele, Nope is an expansive pop epic of uncanny science fiction and complex social thriller that unpacks the seeds of violence, risk, and opportunism that are inseparable from the romanticized history of the American West and from show business itself. A.O. Scott of the New York Times and Peter Howell of the Toronto Star both selected Nope as the best film of 2022. The American Film Institute calls it one of the year's best films, and it's now been included on over 100 top 10 lists of the best films of the year for your consideration in all categories, including Best Picture.
This is Rob Long with Martini Shot for The Ankler. I had a meeting once with a bunch of television studio executives. These are exactly the kinds of meetings I usually try to avoid because, actually, honestly, I avoid all meetings of any type on the grounds that when people get together in a meeting to talk about an issue, they end up talking about why they're going to need several more meetings. But this one I just couldn't wriggle out of because we were talking about contract stuff, actors, writers, that kind of thing. And when you talk about that stuff, you really do need to have a meeting. The studio was having a hard time closing the deal on one of the writers I was trying to hire. "We can't get her to agree to an option," they told me. "If you hire her and she wants to leave the show at the end of the year, we won't have an option on her services." "Fine by me," I said. "She's a good writer, so I'll take what I can get." "But what if she's great?" they asked. "What if she really is super valuable?" "Well, that's good, because that means the show will be better," I said. "But you won't have her in year two," they said, and then they pointed out that some writers who I didn't really want to hire on the project were available and weren't so option-averse. "But if there is a year two of this show," I said, "that will be good. She'll have contributed to that. I mean, the goal is to get to year two, so let's just get there. Let's get to year two. I'd rather have what I can when I can than hire someone I don't really want." "But someone you don't really want will be available in year two," they said. "We feel a lot better about that. It protects us against the downside." "What's the downside again?" I asked. "Well, that she's great and the show is successful," they said. "That's the downside?" I asked. "You know what we mean," they said, which was true. I didn't know what they meant. For an industry that prizes success above all things, which I guess actually every industry does, come to think of it, that's probably a good working definition of the word industry in general, we do spend a lot of time around here worrying about what might happen if everything actually does work out. The various guilds wrangle endlessly over what micropayments will be due which members if the project they're working on somehow makes it through the churning and sinkerator of the system and actually gets made and then ends up in that place roughly the size of a head of a pin generating something called back-end profits or ancillary revenues. Lawyers argue endlessly and expensively about things like sixth-year contract extensions and salary bumps when the international sales hit for clients who haven't even gotten the role yet. They haven't even been offered the gig. "We can't audition an actress for a role," a studio lawyer once told me, "because we haven't closed her deal yet." "I mean, what if something terrible happens?" he asked. "What if she's really good?" Meaning, if you like her, we lose our leverage. If you don't settle the sixth-year fee issue or lawyer out who gets the money from the T-shirts and Reddit memes, you won't be protecting yourself from the upside. And that's probably why I have such a hard time with this stuff, because my feeling is the upside is nothing I need protection from. It's where I want to get. Getting held up in year six, losing an option on a writer who's terrific. These are what I call high-class problems. But in Hollywood, when this kind of thing happens, everyone pretends that the lawyer who did the deal should have had the gift of foresight, should have known that the show with the kid and the dog and the thing was going to get big and have a cartoon or a movie and have a 6 year where the kid and the dog and the thing all demand and get major increases in fees. Me, I'm just trying to get to the point where I can yell at a lawyer for making that deal because that means I've had 5 years of a hit show. But when I mention that to a studio executive, they just suggest that we all sit down for another meeting. And that's the great dividing line between a person's time in show business. When you're starting out, or even before that, when you're just daydreaming about a successful career, all you can see is upside. And then a few years later, after you've experienced some upside, all you can see is the downside of the upside. And I try to remember that when people ask me for career advice. Now, the worst thing you could do for someone trying to break into show business, according to a friend of mine, is encourage them. So don't tell people stories about sudden or unexpected success, or about the YouTube video that catches the attention of a powerful agent, or the random spec script that somebody somehow gets read, that just feeds the daydream machine, says my friend. It doesn't help anybody. Now, Here is a pretty tortured story with names redacted, because I guess that's what you're supposed to do, redact. And it starts this way. A very famous writer and comic actor back in the 1960s was famous for not paying his alimony. And for some reason, he got away with it. And he told another friend of his, not as famous, not as successful, but still a pretty well-known comic actor and writer, that court-ordered payments to his ex-wife or alimony is one of those things that you could just sort of skate on. Of course, it's not, nor should it be. But the friend took his advice, he didn't pay his alimony, and he went to jail. So there was a little bit of justice in there somewhere. And when he got out of jail, he was broke, and he spent the next decade or so trying to get his career back on track, which he kind of did in a pretty spectacular fashion, though he never quite figured out how to handle his money. He was always broke or close to it. Now, cut to about 24, 25, maybe 30 years later. He was cast in a well-known show I was doing. Look, if I'm going to redact, I'm going to redact, but it was Cheers. He was a guest star, a sort of has-been advertising jingle writer, but on shoot night, he had a panic attack, and he raced to his car as the audience members were taking their seats. He drove off the lot, and that was that. We shot what we could that night, and we planned to shoot the rest the following week, which means we needed to recast, and quickly. Now, there was a well-known, brilliant stage actor in New York who had never done half-hour television, but we convinced him to come out and do the role. We needed somebody terrific, somebody hilarious, somebody in 5 days. And he flew out. The part called for someone who could play the piano, and I knew for a fact that this actor could play because I had seen him on stage live playing an old upright piano. But after the reading, when we toured the set and I pointed out the piano and said, "This is where you'll play," he looked at me blankly. "I don't play," he said. "No, but I saw you play," I said. "No," he said. "You saw me pretend to play. The person actually playing was backstage." That's how good he was, by the way. But as I was trying to figure out how we could adjust things, he put his hand on my arm. He said, "Look, if I can make you think you saw me play the piano in real life, I'm pretty sure I can make it look like I can play it on film." Which was totally correct. The week went really well. The episode was funny. The actor that had avoided ever doing television saw that half-hour comedies could be a lot of fun to do and not all that different from appearing in a play. And that was something he was now open to. So barely 10 months later, he was a series regular in a monster hit comedy, which ran for years and netted him a couple of Emmy nominations. And all because one actor had a panic attack doing a role he took because he needed the money, because he was terrible with financial matters, which in part was because he took the bad advice of a more successful friend of his about 30 years before. Now, that's a complicated chain of events, and maybe the dominoes aren't all lined up perfectly, but close enough to remind us that crazy stuff happens, that luck matters. And if you're ready to give up trying to break into show business, well, this kind of story might convince you to stick around another year or two. And if it does, I guess I should be sorry, but I don't know. Maybe you're just one panic attack away from hitting it big. I met a friend recently who I hadn't seen in a few years. Well, it's probably more accurate to say he's a friend of a friend. The last time we met, he had written a feature film script for a low-budget, fast-paced adventure comedy about a diabolical female who swindles her boyfriends and then murders them, and the two ex-boyfriends who manage somehow to survive long enough to team up for revenge. And, okay, his version of the logline is better, but that's the basic gist. Now, I usually do whatever I can to avoid these kinds of meetings because, you know, it's a lot of pages to read, and then nobody really wants to hear what you think of the script. The only reason anyone gives anything they've written to anyone is to hear these exact words in this exact order. "This is the best thing I have ever read. I will do everything in my power to get it produced." Just those words. Anything less leads to a lot of awkward, deflating conversation. So honestly, a few years ago, I didn't read every single page. I flipped through the script. I got the flavor of the general area. I got a sense of the piece. That seemed pretty good. And this is what I said to the friend of a friend when we met for coffee after after I flipped through his script. I said, "This is a funny and fast-paced movie. It seemed to me that if you could get it on film, it would be a big crowd pleaser." "You think I should just go ahead and make it myself?" he asked. "Sure," I said. That's how these things get done. It's how big careers get launched. Just make the damn thing." Which I meant as a general kind of umbrella sense of being encouraging. I meant that he should give up his job and spend his entire savings and go into debt and lose his car and his apartment in the general sense of a kind of umbrella encouragement. In the same sense that I said, I read your script, when what I really meant was I flipped through most of your script. I meant it as a general indicator, not a specific directive. Except when you're the guy who's written a script and you're sitting in a coffee spot in Venice with a guy who, as far as you're concerned, is in the business, and let's be honest, some days that's an awfully generous way to put my exact position. Well, what he means as a vaguely encouraging bromide, you take as the go code. So the friend of a friend did all of that. He quit his job, he cashed in his savings, he ran up his credit cards, he put it all on the line to make his movie. When we met later for coffee, he told me some gripping, harrowing tales of losing his sound guy in Spain, working on a construction site to raise enough cash to pay for a post-production, living in his car, having the finished picture locked away in an editing house in London because the owner had walked away with his last few pennies. And through it all, he said to me, I kept hearing your words. Go ahead and do it. Just make the damn thing. Gosh, I said, I'm really sorry. I meant that in kind of the umbrella sense of general encouragement. Don't be sorry, he said. I'm not. The movie's been a hit at the festivals. Crowds love it. At Glastonbury, they stood up and cheered. Same in Italy and in La Jolla. And I have you to thank. Well, then you're welcome, I said. But I should have said thank you. Because the truth is, if you spend too much time in this business, you forget that there are only two things you really need to be successful. You need a willingness to put it all on the line and an idiot to convince you to do it. Actually, three things. You also need to stop worrying about high-class problems. And that's it for this week. Next week, we'll clean out the notebooks. For The Ankler, this is Rob Long with Martini Shot.